Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I'm joined by Leslie Ann Noel, and this is actually, I believe, her third time being on The Deep Dive. Leslie Ann is a designer, researcher, and educator, and a co-editor of The Black Experience in Design. She has a master's in business administration from the University of the West Indies in Trinidad and Tobago, and a PhD in design from North Carolina State University. She was awarded honorary doctorates for service to the field of design by the University of the Arts London and the Pacific Northwest College of Art. She is currently an assistant professor in the Department Media Arts Design and Technology at North Carolina State University. And as I said earlier, third time guest of The Deep Dive. It's great to have you back on the show. My fellow sister from the West Indies, how are you?
I am well, Phil. It's always nice to be here chatting with you.
Absolutely. This has been circled, underlined, asterisked on my calendar. I'm excited to get into this conversation. And you are also, didn't throw this into the intro, but we're going to be really focusing our conversation on your latest book, which was published as part of the Stanford D School guidebooks. They have 10 of them, I believe, and yours is one of those 10. And it's called Designed Social Change: Take Action, Work Toward Equity, and Challenge the Status Quo. So this book is a dangerous piece of material that I have in my hand, right?
Yes.
Because it's got all the bad words. It's got equity. It's got challenging the status quo. We can't do that anymore. What's going on?
Well, before they batter. You know, someone asked me this morning, like, okay, why did you write this book? Or where did it all start? But I teach a class which it's called Contemporary Issues, but I considered a social studies class for design students. And what would happen every semester is this, you know, after we go through all of these issues, you know, we talk about global issues in general. I ask students to think about oppression and where oppression exists, and then what can they do to address it as part of these contemporary issues. And then at the end of the semester, people are always asking me, okay, I want to go and change the world, and what do I do next? And so I guess that's part of where this book started. It actually even started before that with some of the work that I was doing with children in Trinidad around empowering design education, where I was inviting kids to ask these questions, you know, ask hard questions about the world around them, design a new world, and then try to figure out the path to get there. And then after I started doing empowering design education for children, I then moved that into kind of empowering design workshops for adults. And then I realized, okay, maybe, you know, when I got invited to create a proposal for this book, I thought maybe this is the book actually, right? I taught at the D School at Stanford for a year. And then a few years after that, they reached out to people who taught with them and said, hey, we're coming up with this series of guidebooks. How about you submit a proposal? And so that's one origin story for this book. And I'll give you another kind of origin story in a second or two. But that was it. I was trying to see how could we use some of the ways that we think as designers, you know, like when we're designing something, if you're in graphic design, you'll do the thing, you'll create the prototype, you'll put it out there and you'll get feedback. And then maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work, but you'll start again and you'll do something. And so I've been thinking about that. Can we do the same thing with social change, with the oppressions that people face? Can we just design something, you know, do something, put it out there, get some feedback and start again?
And, you know, that was what was really interesting when I was reading through the book, because very early on, you talk about building critical awareness, right? It's like the first section of the book. And I thought that was so appropriate because it seems like you know, there's a stunning lack of critical awareness across wide areas of our society. You know, it exists in business, it exists in government, it exists in academia, and where all those places intersect, right? So it really led me to this question, which is, you know, how do we solve problems when it seems like we're in a space where there's two scenarios? At the very best, we don't agree as to really what the problems might be. And then at worst, we don't agree that there's a problem at all.
Yeah.
Right? So how do we introduce critical awareness when those seem to be the two prevailing notions, right? And obviously, I know there's people outside those two spaces, but I'm kind of speaking in that muddy middle where there's so much like going on.
I don't even know if I can answer your question, but you're so right that, you know, okay, so I'm a designer. Originally, I was trained to make things pretty, right? And, you know, so maybe there isn't a problem, you know, and I've been critical of even my own education. I love all the places that I've studied and I've been. The first section of the book is very Freirean. You know, it's completely inspired by Paulo Freire. And, you know, that work in Pedagogy Oppressed is about getting oppressed people to see the world around them. So, you know, in that first section of the book, I really am building on what I know of Paulo Freire's work. And that's what I've incorporated into the way that I teach, you know, so that we build in this awareness of the world around us, because it is that awareness of the world around us that allows us to act on the world, you know? So the world doesn't just happen to us. We happen to the world as well, right? And so you're right that there isn't that awareness of the world. And then without that awareness of the world, it really does mean that we, you know, people like me as designers, we end up solving in quotes or addressing the issues that don't make sense or the wrong issues. But really, if we are saying that we want to make major change in the world, then we have to stop and see the world, which isn't always visible. So, you know, some of the strategies in that first section of the book are first starting off with yourself, you know, because I mean, the same way we have to see the world, we have to see ourselves, right? And, you know, even from my own personal perspective, when I stopped to see myself, in quotes, you know, when I learned this practice of reflecting on my identities, that helped me see the way my own agendas would carry through in some of the work that I do, right? And so some, you know, that part of understanding the world is seeing yourself first. And then the next part of the book, you know, the next recipe in the book is about learning to see oppression, you know, or learning to see where people are pushed down. Because again, you know, as we move through the world, we become numb to where people are being pushed down. And then we have to learn to exercise that skill of understanding society is actually pushing people down. And then when we can see that, we can try to figure out how to bring people up again, right? So, you know, all of this is part of this building a critical awareness so that helps us find the questions better that need to be addressed. Or else we'll just be like, changing the colors of things and thinking that we've, you know, we've addressed the design.
Absolutely.
We have to get it'll a little deeper.
It'll all be about pink Barbie, right?
Right.
You know, feminism has solved our problems. What issues, right? Barbie made $1 billion, right? Problem solved.
Not even gonna go solved. There. Yeah.
Well, that's why I'm here.
Yes.
To make sure that we do go there, right? Because, you know, the lunatics that are out there. And you know, I'm very purposeful with my language. So sometimes folks will send me notes online. They're actually very kind, even those that disagree with me. So I don't get like hate mail or anything like that, which I would just delete, right?
Right.
I'm like, not reading your bullshit, right? But, you know, I do get sometimes people will write me and they'll be like, oh, you know, you're so like, denigrating to the other side, right? The other side being conservatives and, right wingers, and shouldn't we engage more thoughtfully in ideas and not resort to name calling, of which I'm very good at, right? And to that, I always say no, right? I am going to call you names. I am going to diminish your point, not because I feel like their points are relevant in the sense that they are part of our lived conversation, but their points are not relevant in the way in which they actually make sense, right? And I framed it like that because I was about to call all these right-wing people lunatics. So I wanted to set the table as to why I'm choosing these words very specifically, right? Because I want to diminish their ideas because their ideas are terrible. And so they actively, though, will find ways to create enemies of things that seem to be just common sense, right? Like we're seeing it unfold in real time with DEI is now evil, right? Critical race theory, to the extent that these people even know what that is, they don't know what it is. Now that's another boogeyman, right? And I've started to notice, because I'm always out there on the margins, that you mentioned Pedagogy of the Oppressed, like that's becoming one of those books, right? So I was sort of like joking at the beginning that, you know, you got all these words that people will find offensive, but I see these idiots like highlighting like everything's oppression and this is the handbook. And they're like linking to this book online, right? Which is a seminal text, a critical text, but also it ain't like the book that everybody's reading on a train going to work, right?
This is still
lives in certain circles, but now it's becoming like public enemy number one. So I'm watching it kind of creep up the charts, the lunatic charts.
Oh, that's so interesting. Pedagogy of the Oppressed was banned in Brazil for a really long time, actually. And it's a book that's kind of invisible. It's educators know that it's there and it exists. And, you know, and we understand that we are trying to create liberating and empowering education. And that book gives us some principles. But it is a difficult read as well in some places.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah. I have to admit it is a hard book. But yeah. I reference it because that notion of oppression, like the other side will fight tooth and nail to the idea that oppression exists. This, like you, whether it's, you know, Elon Musk, you know, Bill Ackman, everyone running for president for the GOP, like they, Tim Scott, you know, head coon in charge, will like stand there and say, like, America is not racist. There is no such thing as oppression. Like,
we know that it exists. And, you know, so when I was writing this book, I found that definition of, you know, oppression, right? I found the translation, oprimere, press down. And if you think about who is pressed down in society, I think that helps you understand that oppression exists. You know, like some people get caught up about isms and say, you know, well, oh, feminism doesn't exist, racism doesn't exist, you know, and they'll be anti all the isms. But I think if we say clearly, people who are pressed down are oppressed, then maybe I'm hoping that they would start to be able to see it more clearly. Right. And there are groups in society that we cannot see as oppressed who are also oppressed. You know, the example I like to use, which is a little bit of a kind of light example, it might not be, but, you know, it's I'm not talking about racism, but, you know, my son is left-handed. And I sometimes use him as an example of, when he was about 12, I interacted with him and he couldn't open a can, and, you know, he was really frustrated. And, you know, I said to him, just open it so that we could leave and go to work. And then he pointed out to me, this is not designed for me to use. And that ends up being then, it's like if he's facing a sort of oppression, because this world wasn't designed for him. And then maybe if we could point out, okay, left-handed people are pressed down. That's a small thing that maybe people can understand. And then we can start to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I'm hoping that if people stay with that metaphor of society pressing people down, then maybe it will get easier for them to see how people are oppressed. And even if they want to say, well, they are oppressed, they can, but tell me how society is pressing you down, right? That's the real thing that I want to hear.
Yeah, because, you know, so much of this also boils down to, like, they'll use the language, you know, in, you know, simple ways, but they try to make these points, right? Like, oh, we're having the oppression Olympics, right? So they start with this place that everything is bad. And so now we're just all competing to see who can claim the lowest status. And by claiming, it's a weird thing, right? By claiming the bottom, to them, it implies power. Because you can use that claim to get the things you want, right? And I look around and I'm like, clearly I haven't gotten that check.
Well, I'm
missing something.
Yeah, I am trying to challenge people to say, well, okay, this is where you push down. What is it that you want, right? And then can we design that thing? And then, you know, maybe find some people to work with us to get there. And it, you know, okay, what I'm talking about is a little bit utopic, but I'm hoping that that focus on utopia can get action going, you know, for some people.
But, you know, I'm glad that word came up. It came up a little earlier than I planned. It's toward the bottom of my notes.
Okay,
right?
Take it back.
But I think it works for us to talk about it here, right? Because again, these are my observations. You're the person studied in the space. But what I've seen when you're having conversations about doing things better, doesn't matter what the thing is or to what degree you want to do it better, the pushback is always like, nothing's perfect. Do you expect it to be utopia? Mm-hmm. Nothing's utopia, right? And I'm curious from your perspective, is utopia as a concept, much less a book, because I'm sure most people haven't read the original book, Thomas More, Utopia, right? So let's assume most people haven't read that. Is utopia as a working term in our society misunderstood in your mind?
Yes. There are probably different understandings. And so generally, yes, it's probably misunderstood. As a person with oppressed identities, right, I want to claim utopia as a concept that I need to latch on to, where this world wasn't designed for me, but I can design the world that I want and I can move towards it. You know, and when someone tells me, oh, well, this is, you know, we can't, everything can't be utopia or whatnot, I, you know, that actually bothers me. Right. Because I think, OK, you, this world was designed for you and maybe you're OK with whatever the world is giving you now. And that's why you want to kind of stop me from dreaming. And yeah, it's, I think utopia is a good place for people to dream about what they need. You know, so I found that the concept of utopia is really good for me to get people dreaming and get people to articulate what it is that they really want, right? And they could do it in different ways, you know, like, so I first did this workshop with children, and it was interesting when I didn't use the word utopia, but I asked the children, what was it that they needed? You know, what was, I did give them space to be critical of the world around them. And then asked them, okay, what is it that you really need? And they were designing these, they had a problem with some fruit trees in their school. And then they started to design these tools that they really wanted so they could pick the mangoes in the school. And, you know, so.
I knew there was a yes. Mango coming up in this conversation. Yes. That is, if you spent any time in various parts of the West Indies, getting access to mangoes is very important.
That was these kids' utopia, you know, and
it's my utopia.
Exactly, you know, and the thing, but the idea of utopia was able to get them to say very clearly or draw very clearly, because not all of them said it, but, you know, they were able to set their minds on something and say, that's the thing that I want. And now I could put something in motion to get, you know, to move there. Whereas, you know, sometimes when you ask people about their future, they can't dream because they say, well, actually, my grades aren't good enough, so I can't dream about X. Or my, they really think about all of the barriers that are holding them back. And I think for me and the work that I do, that concept of utopia that's far away, it's a little bit out there, it's really daydreaming space, you know, that has been useful for me to get people to dream beyond the barriers that might exist today. And so, yes, it might be misunderstood, but I think people like us actually need that space to be able to dream so far away.
Absolutely. I'm a fan, which is why I, you know, the fact that people will throw the nothing's perfect isn't a deterrent, right?
Right.
Like, doesn't mean we can't aim toward that, you know, which on the flip side, it seems like dystopia, right, is far more seductive, right? Like people seem to have no problem thinking through, imagining, planning for the end of the world, right? In some way, shape, or form, whether it's, you know, these survivalist types that want to build bunkers. And those types, you know, when I used to use words like survivalist, people used to think of people with long beards and living out in the hills of Montana and all this kind of stuff. But I'm like, no, these are actually tech billionaires who prefer to think of ways to bunker their lives away from the huddled masses, right? You know, or even pop culture stuff, right? Like how many zombie shows are they, right? Which is really just a dystopian future, right?
Yes.
So my question to you then is, again, like, why does it seem like people have the ability to think of all kind of doomsday scenarios, but yet the more hopeful scenarios seem to be elusive?
Huh, you're asking me difficult questions today.
This is a difficult show.
This is a difficult show.
but we're gonna solve this mango problem, because yes. I'm deeply, deeply engaged in mango procurement.
So you have to think about the utopian, the mango as part of the utopian future, not the dystopian future, right?
Exactly.
No, I think that dystopia has its place as well. But why I've latched onto the utopian is I think that utopia is underutilized, right? Yes, I suppose that there's something fascinating about this dreadful future, you know, and maybe we can tell these engaging stories around it. But, you know, for me, some of those dystopian futures are kind of tied to giving up. You know, when I think of, you know, you talk about the billionaire who's hunkering down and whatnot, I think, wow, that's like, it's almost like if you've given up on the world and society and whatnot. And so you think we're going to go towards that decline when actually, you know, and I am optimistic, right? And, you know, despite everything in the world, I read somewhere that our tendency is in fact to improve and maybe move, okay, our utopian goal is going to change, but as we progress, you know, we are generally getting better and better and better in life. So actually, I think the utopian ideal is more logical than the dystopian future. You know, it's more likely that we're going to move towards that utopian ideal. The actual utopia might change. And it'll change because our goals, you know, as we reach some goals, we'll start to notice something else that needs to be fixed or needs to change. And, you know, so we'll be moving it. And every time we move it, people's lives get a little bit better. You know, if we think about life 100 years ago, 200 years ago, you know, if you think about the advancements in health and education and, you know, the kinds of places that we live in. And yes, we are making, you know, it's more that we are going towards utopia than dystopia. And maybe it is the fact that we are, in fact, moving towards utopia that makes people more fascinated with dystopia, right? That they would prefer this pessimistic scenario than the utopian, than the optimistic scenario.
200 years ago, it was 1824.
Where would we have been, both of us?
I definitely wasn't trying to be around in 1824.
No. No, yeah.
Like, that's a dreadful case scenario for those of a darker hue.
Yes. Did you have friends who would want to time travel and say, oh, well, I want to go back to the 1800s because the clothes were so whatever? Or I don't know. No, you didn't have that? Well, yeah. I'm like,
Black people never have that answer.
No, we didn't want... right? Like... Whatever year was the end of slavery, wherever you're from, we don't want to be in your place before that time, right?
That's the thing, like when people, that's why nostalgia is so interesting, right? When so much of, I think, our current politics, even on both sides, right, is this nostalgia, right? Is, you know, make America great again, it's nostalgia in the name. Right. And Democrats equally no vision have their own version of nostalgia. Right. Like, we're going to go back to Clinton when things were great. Right. Or Obama. Right. Like, you know, those are like their two reference points. And after that, it's like JFK or FDR. Right. Like, they're harking back to all this old shit. Right. And, you know, it's all topic, but interesting in a way that, you know, I think all of us who come from these oppressed, you know, where oppression is part of our identity, which segues me to another question, but I'm going to hold on that. But I want to talk about this a little bit. Like, you recognize that nostalgia is not a place that serves you, right? Like, yeah. I said, like 1824.
No, there would have been slavery right. everywhere. Yeah, yeah. And you know, you jokingly said it's off topic, but no, it's actually on topic, you know, because like at the start of when I was writing this book, I was sitting with my parents talking about how the world was had changed in their lifetimes. That's a very tangible example of, you know, just living people around us, you know, their lives are very tangible examples of just how rapidly the world has changed. And then why actually maybe we don't want to be nostalgic for certain times, you know, like my parents were, you know, they grew up in the 50s and went to college in the 60s. That's recent past. And they both knew spaces that were really segregated. They, you know, even if we talk about not race, but economic situations, something like, I remember going to the outhouse by my grandfather. You know, I don't want to be nostalgic for this era, right? Yeah. I want to keep, you know, moving race, forward. Yes.
Gender, like, you know, my dad, same thing, you know, born 1941. So grew up, you know, came of age, and that's, it sounds like the same time as your parents, right? 50s, 60s, right? And, you know, he would tell me stories, you know, he loved tennis and golf, right? Even as a young boy, like he still watches like nothing but cricket, but which I don't get at all. But nonetheless, he loved the golf and tennis even as a young boy, but could never play them,
because
right?
Like the club was racist.
Yeah, club was racist. The only thing he could do was work at the club, right? So his introduction to the game and learning the game came from like being a caddy or being a ball boy or these kind of things, right? So he still sees that world through those lens, right? So when people will say, oh, it's just in the past, it doesn't matter, it's like,
it's not
the
that
past,
far ago. Yeah,
it ain't that long ago. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I mean, that woman who got Emmett Till murdered just died like last year.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, she's alive and well, chilling. That's why we need Song of Solomon rules.
Yeah.
That's a little secret stealthy drop for folks. Like, read the Song of Solomon. Listen to this, that comment. You will understand what I mean by that.
Well, my drop is coming. But my drop made me think about, you know, just how recent this past is, you know, and then why we need to imagine, well, we need to see what is not acceptable today, because like even 50 years from now, people might be having the same conversation, right? Saying, imagine XYZ. So, I mean, my thing about the left-handers is it's the lightest way I think of introducing this issue, where I say maybe 50 years from now, people will be outraged at the way left-handers were excluded from society, right? And I really try to encourage people to think about, okay, what could be other places where we're pushing people down, so that we start to figure out what could be some other things that just need nudging and shaking up, because the world was designed for specific people. And it's up to us to kind of shake things up and you know, get this world to change to accommodate more people.
Yeah. And there's the default, right? Like, whiteness is still the default, right? Like, let's just call a thing what it is. And I was talking to a good friend of mine, and we were making this observation, right? And it was just a general meandering conversation, but at some point it got to like where there's like some meat in this meandering, right? And I want to bring this up as it pertains to like positionality and identities, right? So our supposition was that at what point does any given room become Black? Like, what's that number? Because I've walked into many rooms. This is 2024. You know, 2024. You know, we're in like, people would think, oh, we're past all this stuff. Many rooms that I walk into that are both social and professional, where I'm still the only Black person.
Yeah, when you asked that question, I was thinking, which country? You know, because I think here... Oh,
this is an American concept, and you're right. Right?
And so but, in these yeah. spaces, these rooms aren't going to become... And I mean, until we I don't expect the rooms to not be white, unfortunately, in America yeah. and in Europe.
And you know, why this matters is because there's also a point where, like, white people become uncomfortable, right? Like, there's a point where they can walk into a room and be like, okay, this looks fairly distributed, and I'm, you know, which means that they're placing themselves somewhere at the top of this room. Right? Like, oh, there's 50 people here and 40 of them are white like me. And, you know, I see there's an Asian, a couple of Blacks, kind of, you know, it all tracks out, right? But then there's a point where if you took that same 50 people and you started to change the dynamics, they ain't comfortable no more. And the room has now become a Black room. Or an other room, right? And I always think about this because you see it all the time in like movies or TV shows. Like, pop culture is a useful template for me, right? And how this pertains to positionality and identity is that, again, we're in this place where identity is a bad word, right? We're fighting against this notion that it's identity pulling us apart. But what they really mean is we are talking. Because whiteness is an identity mm-hmm. too.
Yes, because that's what I was thinking when you were speaking. Everybody has an identity, but if you are from a dominant group, so if you are white, if you're male, if you are whatever the majority.
Those are two of the big ones.
Yes, yeah. Well, I was thinking like, okay, maybe if you're American, you don't see your dominant identity and you don't understand that that is actually an identity. And you really have to stop and consciously see that dominant identity, you know, to take it into consideration and understand how that dominant identity affects the way you show up in the room, right? It really takes some reflection on that, you know? And so, I mean, we all have maybe dominant identities in some place. So like when I'm in Trinidad, or actually, that was an example of my dominant identity taking over, because I'm from Trinidad and Tobago, right? And when I'm in, my home country, I don't recognize then my Trinidadianness as my dominant identity, and that I will probably not give the same kind of maybe value to someone from Tobago, you know, just because of the way that dominant subordinate kind of identity shows up. And so really it is the thing about positionality is that reflecting on our positionality causes us to stop and think about all of these identities, you know, dominant identities, subordinate identities, and try to think about how these identities affect the things that we do, or how does it affect how we show up in the world, right? And It could be about race and whiteness and blackness. It could be about age. Could be, you know, about so many things. You know, the dominant identity that we probably both have and don't think about. We speak English, right? And so we're not going to reflect on that as we do things. But yeah, it's really for us to everyone to think about what are these identities and how are they going to affect the work that we do and how are they going to affect how we show up in rooms and spaces and things like that.
Absolutely. You know, it was one of the really more, the entire book is interesting, but I love the chart that you had around positionality because I think it invited us to think about all the different ways in that we are made up of these really dynamic bits and pieces. And it's very hard to limit ourselves to just one thing, right? Because none of us are just one thing. Like I tell folks all the time, I'm West Indian, but I was born here and I bring Brooklyn into every room that I go into, right? Like I carry Brooklyn on my back in a very passionate way. But that's just one part of that identity, right? And you get challenged on your identity too. Cause yeah, my mom's from Barbados, my dad's from Guyana, but when I go home, they'd be like, yo, you American.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. Like you yeah. know.
But you know, society just flattens us.
Yeah.
And like, so, you know, when I start with a new class, I just want to rough things up, you know, that let's unflatten the people in this room. And so, you know, like, so that activity that I have is around 12 different elements of identity. But also those aren't the only things that we have to think about, you know, like those are just like 12 little points that we could start thinking up about. But, you know, there are other things that it could be religion, it could be political affiliation. It could be even like who's from Global North and Global South. You know, there's all of this complexity that we have to try to figure out how can we make space for more complexity, even though society will just tend to flatten people and make assumptions about this flattened identity that people see first.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you have another great analogy in the book. Again, one of my more favorite things, cooking.
Right? Ah, yeah. Like,
you mentioned that the book is laid out and your thought process was very much like a cookbook, right? And that really resonated with me. One, because I love to eat. I love to cook. And I actually love cookbooks too. Like I have quite a few cookbooks. And it made me kind of think about, you know, I think when I look at your book, you're cooking a particular type of futures, plural, right? Like your cookbook is designed to get us to a different place, right? This utopian place. But there's folks out there cooking a different cookbook.
That is true.
They got that oppression cookbook.
Yeah, which we need to get rid of.
It is filled with recipes.
We need to throw away those oppression recipes and dump those oppression ingredients. They're past their due date, right? And really, yeah, I like where you're taking my analogy, but yeah, I've wanted people to just, you know, I just thought, okay, could it be easy? You know, could we just put together these ingredients and oppression is over, right? And I know that that's an oversimplification. It's maybe an intentional oversimplification, but the idea, you know, I've been playing this for several years that actually sometimes people want steps to follow, right? And they want to understand ingredients and they want to understand how to mix ingredients well and get, you know, bread that tastes good and whatnot. So I've been kind of working this analogy for a few years. What are actually the ingredients for good design and then the ingredients for good society, right? And, you know, can we somehow write the stuff down and let people either follow the steps and get things right? Or can we teach the ingredients so well so that people can intuitively combine these ingredients and get the food right? And, you know, actually the original name for the book in my proposal was something like Afro-Caribbean Girls Cookbook for the Future or something. It was like, you know, it was like supposed to be this guide to this ultra supersonic future or something like that. And then my editor, who was fantastic. You know, she let me work that metaphor for quite a bit. And okay. Then she kind of massaged it another direction afterwards, right?
But I probably would have liked that too, but it sounds a little longer than where we landed.
But you know, I've kind of played in my mind like, okay, will I write that one? Mm-hmm. And I might one day actually write that cookbook. What was nice about this book actually was that it wasn't an academic writing.
Yeah,
it was really supposed to be. I want to say fun. The cookbook part is where it started off as really fun writing. And then I actually took some heavy academic content, you know, like Freire and about levels of oppression and, you know, that kind of more academic theory. But I tried to make it accessible to everybody without dumbing it down.
Yeah, and absolutely.
I don't know if I did it, but yeah.
No. I would say mission accomplished in that sense, right? Because what it does is it gives you a lot of prompts for you to place yourself in a lot of these situations, right? Like as a, you know, straight Black guy of a certain age, coming of age at a certain time, I'm constantly running through a lot of the shit, you know? So you can do things better, right? And it's interesting as a Black male, because you know, there was a point when we were kind of at like the height of the Me Too moment, for example, right? And that's an ongoing process. But so I'll say that there was a time when it was in the news every day, and now we're not at that time, right? Where folks are like, men are the problem, right? And I'm like, I'm all for that, right? Like, I'm the first to say that men are irritating as shit, right? But I'm like, Black dudes was running a lot of these organizations, right?
No, so it's like, yeah.
You know, but we got our own issues, yes. Right? So I know I move in the world and embody maleness, which has challenges. But then Black maleness has different set of challenges. Some overlap, right? Because brothers be on the bullshit, right? So I'm not letting brothers off the hook. But the way in which power moves is different. Right. And I think what your book does is it invites you to come into these spaces and ask yourself questions, which I hope it give you better results at the end of it. Right. Like you're left with thinking through some of these ways in which you are part of these systems. Where are you in these systems? How are you complicit in them? Right. Like I say all the time, I live in New York. Right. Like I'm part of the problem as it pertains to those who are living in less fortunate places. Why my life is cheap.
Yeah. We are all part of the problem, right? We are all part of some problem somewhere in the world, you know, and that's, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but, you know, that's why I come back to that thing of, okay, us learning to see the world and figure out where people are being pressed down, whether it's us being pressed down or whether it's other people, we have to learn to see that. And then we can react to that. You know, we can try something out. That's actually the other reason I liked the cooking metaphor is I wanted people to move into action and then you try something. And if it doesn't work out, you can edit the recipe and try something again. You know, like I make bread with no recipe. And sometimes it's great and sometimes it's awful. And if it's awful, we try it again, right? Yeah. Whereas sometimes
it just goes to the birds.
Or, you know, the other trick, we just eat it hot. Because hot food always tastes good. It doesn't matter if it's fantastic or not. Just make sure it's hot.
That's a good hack.
Yeah.
But I have a different hack with wine. If I buy wine that's not so great, I'm like, well, you know, drink it faster. It'll get better.
I thought you were going to say cook with it, but yes.
No. drink it quicker.
That probably works as well.
That wine you thought wasn't so great, all of a sudden, much better.
Yeah, I think that probably works too.
I mean, I'm going to get us into the drop, but you know, as always, it's been a great conversation with you. I'm going to read the full title of the book and then we're going to get into the drop. Again, it's called Design Social Change, Take Action, Work Toward Equity, and Challenge the Status Quo. All things that we need to be heavily engaged in. And this is a great book to kind of get you thinking in that direction. So in the time that we have left, I want to get us to the drop. And the drop is just an opportunity to share anything at all with my listeners of the show. They're always very passionate about the drops. I got lots of notes on drops and people send me their own drops. And I'm like, hey man, send me the drop, but you're not on the show. But no, in all seriousness, keep sending me those things. So they are very interesting. I have two drops this week. The first one is from an artist named Cy Smith. Cy is awesome. She's been in the game for a long time, has a new record out called Until We Meet Again. You can find it anywhere. I listen to it mostly on Spotify, but this is fresh at the time we're recording this. This came out like last week. And my other drop is a movie called The Creator with John David Washington, also known as Denzel Washington's son, which is what I call him most of the time. Like, yo, Denzel's son, right? And this book is actually set in a somewhat dystopian future, but it's super interesting. I think it's one of the more interesting looks at humanity, technology, and AI that I've seen in a film. And he does a really good job in it. And it's a really, really, really good movie. And it's called The Creator. Available on most streaming sites, but I think here in the U.S. it's streaming on Hulu, but that'll be in the show notes. So those are my two drops, and you are up.
Okay, so I also have two drops. And the first drop is The Color Purple, the new,
The new one.
The new one, yes. Okay. So I went to see that a few days ago, and it was just such a beautiful movie. You know, it's such a compelling story. They are chopping onions in the movie theater, so you might shed a tear or two. But it's I left speechless, you know, at again how recent this movie is. It's set between I think 1909 and maybe 1949. And, you know, when you think about all of the things that these people, you know, this character in particular had to go through, that wasn't so long ago, it really makes you aware again of how the world needs to change and how we've made so much progress and more progress needs to happen. So that I really encourage people to go out and see The Color Purple. My other drop is not so recent. It is The Will to Change by Bell Hooks. It's The Will to Change Men, Masculinity, and Love. I read that book a few years ago after a breakup. And I think that Bell Hooks, she writes this book about men, masculinity, and love. And she actually writes in such a tender way about how patriarchy affects men as well. And so how patriarchy makes living difficult for men. And then actually there's some point in the book where she says it's men's love for their daughters that actually humanizes them and maybe allows them to flourish again in the world. And I've encouraged men to read this book. Almost like every man I have met, I'll say, okay, you need to read The Will to Change Men, Masculinity, and Love. And a few of them have gotten back to me and said that really the book opened up the way that they think about masculinity and manhood. And so that's my drop.
Those are two amazing drops. Like a couple of weeks ago, I was recording and I recommended Alice Walker just broadly. I was like, read The Color Purple, but read Alice Walker deeply, like her books, her work, her letters that are published. And Bell Hooks is always a good drop. Like Bell Hooks, you can't go wrong with Bell Hooks. And it's really interesting. It's probably topic for another show. And I don't want to open us up into having another show right now on this show. But, you know, there was a Financial Times article that came out this week, and it got sent to me by a good friend. And then subsequently I read it in other places about this huge gap between women and men. And they did this study that anywhere you look in the world, kind of globally, men and women's ideas of their place in the world are wider and wider diverged. So women are becoming more progressive in their politics and their ideas. Men are becoming more conservative. And they're like, it's everywhere. It's in Korea, it's in the United States, it's in parts of Africa. They did a whole global study. And here you find a lot of popular male pundits, like talking about this crisis of manhood, right? Like Scott Galloway is one of these clowns that wants, men are so hard being a man now. And oh my God, I'm crying. Jordan Peterson is another fucking idiot. And I'm like, if men let go of their own bullshit,
they'd be happier.
They'd be happier, right? Yes. So for all these men that wring their arms and twist and cry, I'm like, why don't you read bell hooks?
Yes.
There's and other women thinkers. Like there's tons of them out there that you can read that can give you a better solution to your problems, your perceived problems than women, which is always the solution to their problem. Women are our problem. Like, you're an idiot.
No,
Jordan Peterson and Scott Galloway.
It's not women who are the problem. It is that this male world is the problem, actually. Yeah.
It's these
right?
stupid ideas. And unfortunately, again, topic for another show, this crosses into, you know, I highlighted Scott Galloway and Jordan Peterson as two well-deserving idiots. But there's lots of, like, black guys who think the same bullshit.
You know,
that are out there pumping nonsense and toxic garbage to other black males, and they must be stopped.
They must be stopped.
Charlemagne the God, I'm looking at you, idiot.
Well, I'm going to give another drop. You didn't ask me for a third drop, but I'm going to give you a third drop. You know, because I was talking, my drop was bell hooks. And the last time I shared that book with some of my students, I had one student in my class who was really... maybe brought up in a kind of toxic male kind of environment. And he was like, yeah, but it's a woman who's tearing us down. So I do have a male book about masculinity that I think is really also good for men to read, The Descent of Man by Grayson Perry. And, you know, he challenges what he calls outdated versions of manhood and, you know, really asks men to think of what is it that makes men, right? And, you know, could there be other ways of seeing masculinity? So that's another one that I'll share with you.
Oh, perfect. I've just got that one down. So I'll check that one myself. Leslie Ann, this was amazing. We had an amazing pre-talk. We had an even better episode. I'm always excited to have you on with me. The book is amazing. Your work is amazing. I know there's going to be a fourth time and a fifth time and a sixth time. We're stuck together.
I'm going to start writing another book just for that. Yes.
Start writing another book and I'll have you on again. Thank you so much for being on A Deep Dive with me.
Thank you so much.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.